The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, then let's begin with the material of the course, and I shall try to be as clear as possible. If, however, there are questions as we go along, then feel free to raise your hand and ask. The format, as we had it last time at least, is that we go from 7:15 until approximately 8:15. And then we'll have a break. We'll have a 10-minute break and then come back until 9:15. That gives you a chance to stretch your legs, and if there's any coffee or anything available, to get that or chat a little bit. If you want to chat with me and ask some questions, that will be all right too, but then in a private way. Well, let's enter in then to some introductory materials. So we start in then with the introduction. Now, when Professor Herman Bovink, I'll put some of these things on the board here so that we do not take too much for granted. Some people ask me sometimes whether I'm Dutch. I don't know whether I look I'm Dutch or not. Don't answer that question. But in any case, I do know this. When I'm in Luxembourg, people from the surrounding countryside address me in German. They think that I'm German, I guess. So, well, anyway, I guess I don't pass very well for a Dutchman. Herman Bovink is the name of a very famous theologian, a Dutch theologian. And when he retired from the Free University of Amsterdam, two professors were appointed to teach in his place. The Free University was started by Dr. Abraham Kuyper. We shall have to say more about him the second hour. It was started in 1880. And later on, Bovink became a professor there. And when he retired, then from the Free University, two professors were appointed to teach in his place. Bovink had taught philosophy as well as theology. He had had these two areas to teach, philosophy and theology. Now, to replace him in the field of theology, in theology then, Professor Valentine Hepp was appointed, H-E-P-P, Valentine Hepp, who, by the way, wrote a biography on Bovink. Now, philosophy was separated from theology and was entrusted to the young professor D.H.T.H. Vollenhoven. This is the way it is written most of the time. It's actually Dirk Hendrik Theodor, if you want to know the whole moniker. Dirk Hendrik Theodor Vollenhoven, or D.H.T.H. Vollenhoven, as it is most often written. Now, at the same time, in 1926, because these appointments were in 1926, another professor was appointed, but to the Faculty of Jurisprudence, the Faculty of Law, or Jurisprudence. And this was Professor Herman Dooyeweerd. Now, languages do funny things. Long ago, years ago, when I came here as a student, Dr. Ventil saw me in the library, which was then the library, which is the old carriage house upstairs, about where one of the, not where the stacks are in the book room, but where one of the lower bookshelves is. And he asked me whether I would learn the Dutch language so I could read this philosophy. And he had particularly in mind a 3-volume work of Dooyeweerd. And so I began to read some Dutch, and it seemed to me to be a strange language that had all these vowels in it, double E's and double O's and so forth. Very strange thing indeed. It doesn't look so strange now because I'm used to it. But the double O here is not do, as so it's do. It's a long O. Dooyeweerd. Dooyeweerd. Dooyeweerd then came to be in the faculty of jurisprudence, or the faculty of law. Now together, then, Vollenhoven and Dooyeweerd, who happened to be brothers-in-law, developed a Christian philosophy that came to be known by the name of one of Dooyeweerd's early major works. They developed together a philosophy which came to be known by the name of one of Dooyeweerd's early works, that is the philosophy of the law idea, or as it later came to be called, cosmonomic idea. Some people like this word and some hate it, but that is a matter of taste to a great extent, I suppose. In any case, Vollenhoven and Dooyeweerd, who happened to be brothers-in-law, developed a Christian philosophy that came to be known by the name of one of Dooyeweerd's early major works, the philosophy of the law idea, or in Dutch, de wijsbegeerte de wetsidee. As the stories, of course, you can't have these professors without having stories about the professors. I'll try to tell a few of them as I go along to give just a little bit of background. Years ago here at the seminary, we had what we call stunt night. Now, you folks have refined upon that type of thing. Now you ask the professors to do stunts instead of the students, you see. But I don't know if any of you are old enough here to remember the time that I cynically tried to shoot basketballs over my head without looking. I didn't hit any of them, but in any case, for stunt night, the students used to imitate the professors. Well, I told my wife one time that I was assiduously cultivating certain idiosyncrasies so that the students would imitate me at stunt night, and she said I didn't have to bother. Well, at any rate, some of the other professors don't have to bother either. There is a story of Dooyeweerd, who one night was studying, as he usually did, and his beloved wife came up and said she had to go over to her sister-in-law's place. And since she didn't want to come home through the streets of Amsterdam that late at night, would her husband kindly come over and pick her up? All right. So her husband didn't come. And so she came home and went up to her husband's study and kissed him goodnight and went to bed. And all of a sudden, a while later, Dooyeweerd woke up to the fact that he hadn't gone to get his wife. And so he went dutifully over to Vollenhoven's place about 1 a.m. and knocked on the door and woke everybody up and so forth. As I say, one sometimes does not need to cultivate certain idiosyncrasies. Now, soon this philosophy began to attract the attention and interest of others who had been raised in Calvinistic circles. One of them, and this is the way it's done usually, Professor H.G. Stoker, S-T-O-K-E-R. I think, again, this is Hendrik. I honestly, at the moment, forget what the middle initial stands for, so I won't wager anything. But H.G. Stoker. Stoker had been earlier a student of Max Scheler, the very well-known German philosopher Max Scheler. Shaler was a phenomenological thinker. He was a very well-known member of the phenomenological school in philosophy. Stoker had been his student, and he attempted to give an individual expression to this way of Christian philosophy in his native land of South Africa. So from South Africa, you had someone interested in this, H.G. Stoker, who tried to give it his own individual expression. In America, Dr. Cornelius Van Til expressed interest, our own Dr. Van Til, especially in terms of his own effort to erect a consistently reformed apologetics. That, of course, has been Dr. Van Til's ideal, his passion, you might almost say. And he, even as he says in later writings, he was interested in this, especially in terms of his own effort to erect a consistently reformed apologetics. Now, another co-worker, and the names of these people appeared in the scholarly journal for many years together, a scholarly journal, Philosophia Reformata, of this movement. Another early co-worker was the respected Austrian Calvin scholar, Josef Boateng. I have myself, the last couple of years, been able to read some of his works. Respected Calvin scholar indeed, an increasingly influential Calvin scholar, and a member in a broad sense of this school. And I've enjoyed this reading exceedingly, and I hope that soon something will be coming out in print that reflects that reading. Now, this philosophy is of interest to us, at least because of the following considerations. Some people react very positively to these things, and others react rather negatively, and we shall be seeing that. But it's of interest to us, at least because of the following considerations. In the first place, it claims to be the first attempt to erect a Calvinistic philosophy, and we might say a consistent Christian philosophy on the basis of the principles of the Reformation. It claims to be the first attempt to erect what we might call a consistent Calvinistic philosophy, or a consistent Christian philosophy that is built on the principles of the Reformation. So it has that claim, a certain claim to exclusivity here that bothers some people and entrances others. Now, in the second place, it has been able to attract a number of able followers. I mentioned Boateng. He is a very able Calvin scholar. He did a great deal of archive research. He is increasingly influential. I've read several books during my recent sabbatical that have been influenced by him. Doyevaert himself is regarded to be one of the most outstanding intellects that Holland had produced. Stoker is, to use a vernacular bit, is no slouch. Vollenhoven has had probably, as we shall see, influence among the younger generation, men who are my age, if I'm young anymore, and younger. In other words, those who came along afterward, he has had as great an influence or greater influence than Doyevaert himself. And we, of course, know the influence of Dr. Van Til. So, I say it has been able to attract a number of able followers and form a school that has attracted notice and has had influence in Calvinistic circles and beyond. It's attracted then, able followers. It has attracted notice. It's had influence in Calvinistic circles and beyond. I dare say, in terms of things that are going on, that this interest and this influence will grow rather than diminish. I'm no prophet, neither the son of a prophet, but it does seem to me reasonable to expect that it will. In the third place, the philosophy is undergoing development. In fact, I was in Holland recently in December. I led a staff, what they call colloquium, discussion group of the staff of the interfaculty at the Free University. And I came out with some ideas, and I'm afraid I was rather pegged as an orthodox Dorivertian, at least in some of my ideas. These people belong to the movement in a general sense, and yet there is the very definite effort to attempt to go beyond the masters to undergo their own development. The philosophy is undergoing development. New statements are being made, and old positions are being elaborated in vital areas. Now, one of the areas in which statements are being made and positions are being elaborated, sometimes new positions, positions that have rather definite implications for change, is the relationship of philosophy and theology. It's an embarrassment, of course, to have been occupied, even preoccupied with a particular science, maybe for many years, and then suddenly be brought into a bind where you have to ask whether, and to give an account of what you're doing, and to ask yourself the question, is what you're doing really meaningful? And very often we do theology and we don't think enough on the foundations of theology. In fact, I asked Professor Murray very shortly before his retirement years ago, I asked him whether he had given much attention to prolegomena. And he said he recognized the great importance of it, but that he had not given as much attention as he would like to have given, and he was sorry for that. We sometimes don't, even the best, do not give enough attention to the method of that science which they are occupied in. And this school has attempted to reflect upon the relationship of philosophy and theology. Another area in which it was active is philosophical anthropology, the doctrine of man, but understood philosophically. Philosophical anthropology. And this, I dare say, is a tremendously important area. Dorivert called it the crown of his own philosophizing, namely his philosophical anthropology. It is a most important area, and even in the very contemporary times, in Marxist circles, for example, one of their major preoccupations was the new man. How does the new man appear? That would have to deal with philosophical anthropology. Now there are discussion of particular questions relating to law, techniques or technology, and so forth. Dorivert, very much involved in law jurisprudence. I happen to be in contact with his successor at the Free University, Hayef and Aika Mahomas, who is also dealing with questions of jurisprudence. Van Riesen, with the Society of the Future, as is translated into English, deals with techniques and or technology. And there is a man, Schuurman, at the moment at the Free, who is dealing also with these areas. So there's been discussions of particular questions, for example, relating to law and technology. Now, in the fourth place, the movement is subject to discussion and even to vigorous criticism in Christian circles. I mentioned this in a little introduction I wrote to a pamphlet by Dorivert, The Secularization of Science, which is available over here in the bookstore, I believe. I figure in a day when everyone watches television, you must have at least one commercial an hour. And so I'll come up with a commercial every once in a while. You don't have to rush out and buy the book or something like that. There'll be no 800 number to phone, but nevertheless, just to make you feel at home in a television age, we'll have a commercial every once in a while. But in this little introduction there, I do point this out, that this is subject to criticism, and that, from the standpoint of the philosophy, is not at all bad, because, as I say, it does not aim to canonize itself. It is simply a human attempt to understand God's creation in his good a fashion as possible, as well as possible, in the light of his word, and any such human effort is subject to criticism, and it invites it. It has been subject to discussion, even to vigorous criticism in Christian circles. And this discussion appears to be swelling rather than diminishing. I might just mention there are several centers, even on this continent, where discussion is going on. You have, of course, your school, the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto. I dare say the lion's share of those folk up there are influenced by Bollenhoven and persons like Van Riesen more than they are by Dooyeweerd. But nevertheless, be that as it may, there is where this type of discussion is going on. Dordt College is a center of discussion. There are discussions at Calvin College. We've had discussions here at Westminster. There is the Christian Studies Center in Memphis, Tennessee, which is Kuyperian-oriented, and where discussion goes on. And I might add, the Association for Public Justice is a group in this country where certain principles connected with this philosophy are being advanced, or at least stimulated by this philosophy. It would seem that even since the last time I taught this course, this statement has been confirmed that the discussion appears to be swelling rather than diminishing. Now, for these and other reasons, the philosophy appears to be worthy of being surveyed and subjected to critical examination. It's worthy of our survey. It's worthy to be subjected to critical examination. I shall attempt, as well as I have it in me, according to my best powers, to present each position in the strongest way I can, in the most forceful way, in the most congenial way I can. And then, however, I shall be taking a distance to things that one or another has said. There will be also a critical distance which is taken, which is our duty. Now, the name of the philosophy, now largely called the philosophy of the cosmonomic idea, is to erect, for the first time, as I have intimated, on the basis of the principles of the Reformation, a philosophical framework. They have the sense of this initial effort to erect, for the first time, on the basis of the principles of the Reformation, a philosophical framework of ontology, doctrine of being, epistemology, doctrine of knowledge, and so on, ethics, you can spell that, I'm sure, logic, and so forth. And indeed, there has been a remarkable effort, I think, in this direction. I might mention that I myself have been benefited from these studies, and I hope that you will also, but there have been the studies in these various directions with the intent, for the first time, to erect a consistent Christian philosophy on the foundations presented by the Reformation. Now, if philosophy, then, is understood as an attempt to gain by theoretical means a universal view of the world. Now, we're launching out here a bit, and so let me make sure that that statement I just made gets across. I'll erase a few things here from the board so that we have just a little room to write a little bit more intelligibly up there. But if philosophy is understood as an attempt to gain by theoretical means, in other words, not just saying I believe this and I believe that, but by theoretical means, presenting argument and what have you, if philosophy is understood as an attempt to gain by theoretical means a universal view of the world, of all of its aspects in their mutual interdependence and coherence, we're attempting to get, by theoretical means now, a universal view of the world in all of its aspects and their mutual interdependence and coherence, does it not assume that there is a universally adequate agent of philosophic inquiry? There is the question with which I have for some time started out, because it's a very important one to this philosophy to understand it. If philosophy is what we say it is, we could elaborate a little further this definition, but if it is quite along this line, does it not assume that there is a universally adequate agent of philosophic inquiry? Now, Etienne Gilson, claimed that it is impossible to erect a philosophy on the basis of Reformation teaching, or on a reformational basis with a large R, capital R. He claimed it's impossible to erect a philosophy on the reformed or reformational basis. The view of the Reformation that man is totally depraved and that it is impossible for him to attain to truth except on the basis of divine revelation makes it impossible to erect a Christian philosophy. Now try to get that. No Christian philosophy on the basis of Reformation principles. Why? The view of the Reformation that man is totally depraved and that it is impossible for him to attain to truth except on the basis of divine revelation makes it impossible to erect a Christian philosophy. Man totally depraved? You don't have any real, then, adequate agent of philosophic inquiry. Therefore, a philosophy is impossible. Another point, should one so desire, he would have to assimilate philosophy into theology. Do you believe that a Christian philosophy is possible, or a philosophy is possible only on the basis of divine revelation? Then what you're doing is theologizing. You are taking up philosophy into theology, you are theologizing philosophy, or you are assimilating philosophy into theology, as I put it the first time. This would mean the destruction of philosophy in any true sense of the word. In other words, if there is not a terrain of philosophy in which there is a universal agent, someone, a universal subject, you might say, that can do philosophy, apart from divine revelation, which is understood by theology, then what happens is that you assimilate philosophy into theology with the idea also of total depravity. You disqualify your subject. There is no adequate agent of philosophical inquiry. No Christian philosophy on this basis is possible. Now, he says, a philosophy is both possible and necessary on the basis of the Roman Catholic position. The Catholic position regarding nature allows for the idea of a universal human reason. You see, there is the idea, he says, on Romanist basis, of a universal reason, a universal human reason that is indeed injured and weakened by the fall into sin. Now this universal reason is then injured. It may be scarred, may have bruised members. It's weakened indeed, but it is essentially sound. It's essentially sound. The structure is essentially untouched. It is essentially sound. And it can be aided by grace. Can be aided by grace. And so it is possible, according to the classic position, for reason to act as a preamble of grace. Now, it's not our purpose to go in great detail into this position here, but very largely to think in terms of an area of nature in which there is this universal philosophic agent, universal, following universe, there is a universal human reason, and then even though there it is injured, it can nevertheless be aided by help, by grace. So reason acts as a preamble of grace. Now the attempt to wed the genius of the Reformation with philosophy and to emerge with the Christian philosophy was also rejected as impossible by the dialectical theology of Karl Barth. Now, coming out of a different corner, you might say, Barth then also rejected the idea of a Christian philosophy. And in doing this, Barth was dependent upon the Danish thinker Soren Kierkegaard. Again, in Danish, you have some of these double A's here. And in Danish, that's an O sound. So it's Kierkegaard, Søren Kierkegaard. Well, at any rate, it was rejected by the dialectical theology of Karl Barth in its dependence upon Søren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard believed that if you are to realize the goal of philosophy, if something answers to the inner nature of philosophy, it means that the truth can be framed in such a way as to be grasped by everyone directly. That was one of his categories. We can grasp something directly. That is, we could grasp it philosophically. We can grasp it as I might grasp an eraser. The realization of the nature of philosophy means that the truth can be framed in such a way that it can be grasped by everyone directly. Now, if I remember my Kierkegaard, first of all, this was the ideal that Kierkegaard set for himself, that he would be a philosopher and that he would be able to have a direct apprehension of the truth. But he came to the conclusion that Christianity, on the other hand, could not be grasped directly, but only by the roundabout way of the consciousness of sin and the acknowledgement of guilt. So, Kierkegaard, philosophy, direct apprehension. Nevertheless, if you're going to grasp Christianity, that had to be an indirect way, and that was then the roundabout way of the consciousness of sin and the acknowledgement of guilt. Now, at first, Kierkegaard embraced a supposedly direct, and his way of thinking, immanent way of philosophy. Approach it directly, that would mean for him imminently. That was the way he wanted to go, as I mentioned. At first, he embraced a supposedly direct, immanent way of philosophy. But later, he turned to what he regarded to be the indirect, paradoxical way through the consciousness of sin. If I'm going to grasp Jesus Christ, it cannot be directly by simply laying hold on Jesus Christ, but what he regarded to be indirectly by the consciousness of sin, by the paradoxical way, as he put it, through the consciousness of sin. He thought the ways of philosophy and of Christianity were diametrically opposed to each other as immanence and paradoxical transcendence. Now here is their immanence transcendence idea. Direct apprehension is immanence. Paradoxical transcendence, that is the transcendent that belongs to the area of what he called religion B, or the area of Christianity. Now following Kierkegaard, Barth claimed that a Christian philosophy is a bastard concept. There cannot be a wholesome wedding of Christianity and philosophy. I remember I was over in Basel in the late 50s, just before I finished my doctoral dissertation. I was studying Karl Jaspers, who was then professor of philosophy at the University of Basel, and I also sneaked in on some lectures and some discussion groups of Karl Barth. And I remember Karl Barth Oh, what can a place like Basel University have to do with Christianity, you know, with a wave of the hand? And he was very much against those people down there in the flatlands of Holland who were following Abraham Kuyper and were attempting to wed Christianity and philosophy. Such a wedding cannot be wholesome. Indeed, he admitted, theology employs philosophical concepts. You can't do theology without employing certain general concepts drawn from philosophy. But theology is fundamentally free from them. It must use them, but it is fundamentally free from them. It's apparently free to take it or leave it. It was fundamentally free from these philosophical concepts. Theology is not bound to any particular philosophy, but employs philosophical concepts while remaining finally aloof from them. Employ them, indeed. You must use them. You do theology and you'll be using these general concepts which are taken from philosophy. But theology is basically free from them. It can take it or leave it. It is finally aloof from them. Theology is not bound to any particular philosophy, but employs philosophical concepts while remaining finally aloof from them. Even freer, indeed altogether free, is God and his revelation. Let's not bind God's revelation to a philosophy. Let's not bind it to anything, because God is free, and the revelation of God is free, the Word of God is free. We want a theology of the Word, and that is of the Word that expresses the freedom of God. Now, he said, to suppose otherwise is to leave evangelical truth. Now, you see how serious it gets. You try to bind the Word to philosophy as to leave evangelical truth in order to return, as the Israelite people did want to, at least to the flesh pots of Egypt. Now, from the side of Roman Catholicism with the nature grace scheme, and from the side of dialectical theology, therefore, there was a forceful denial of the possibility of a Christian philosophy, or at least the denial that such a philosophy can be erected on a Protestant foundation. Now, either you had an outright rejection of a Christian philosophy, or at least a claim, a denial that such a philosophy could be erected on the foundation of the Reformation. I remember again, excuse me for all this years ago business, but I'm afraid it was years ago. I knew at Union Theological Seminary the son of a Dutch banker of Rotterdam. His name is Jaap Mees, and I saw him over in Holland. He took me through the tunnel in Rotterdam with his car and so forth. I remember getting off the boat and trying to find my way a little bit by talking to a policeman, but I didn't know any Dutch much. They said for all the Dutch I knew, the students of the Free said they could have sold me as a slave somewhere and I wouldn't have known the difference, but it got a little bit better after that. But he took me there, and I shall tell you a story that will go down to posterity. I think I could write a book, I'm sure that no one would want to buy it, but of my first encounter in Holland, how I did not get to see Albert Schweitzer. Because I didn't know my way around at all, you see, and there were these two girls whom I got to know from Oregon who were going to go to Amsterdam on the train. We had all our baggage and stuff, and here my friend was taking me in his car before the train would go. He said, Albert Schweitzer is staying at our home. Would you like to postpone your going to the Free University for one day and come and meet Albert Schweitzer? Well, I was in an awful bind. I thought, well, if I don't go to the Free, now's the day when I said I would arrive. Maybe they'd give my room to someone else, and then where would I stay? Furthermore, I don't know the language and all these thoughts, but when do you get a chance to see Albert Schweitzer? So finally, I said no. I went with the two girls from Oregon to Amsterdam, I was trundled along with my trunk on one of these little, they had those times, it's called a bakfiets. They had a sort of a box, a wooden box in the front, the bike in the back and two wheels in the front. And I was trundled with my trunk to the Free University, got my room and so forth. But I've always thought that I might write a chapter of a book sometimes, how I did not get to see Albert Schweitzer. If that book never appears, it's because I've come to my senses and I realize that that would be a very strange title and probably no one would want to read about that experience. Well, at any rate, be that as it may, the situation is further complicated by the fact that the dialectical theology, the theology of Barth, following Kierkegaard and his view of an antithesis then, or close to it, between theology and philosophy, claims to be following in the line of the pure motives of the Reformation. In opposition to the analogy of being idea, we'll have more to say about that, the analogy of being idea of Rome, or the analogia entis, as it is called. I really have to admire my daring in telling that story when it's going on the tape out to California and to Florida. Maybe they have seen Schweitzer and know all about it. I don't know. Well, in any case, this situation then is complicated by the fact that the dialectical theology, in its opposition to the analogia entis of Rome, claims to represent the pure motives of the Reformation. Now, it denied that there can be a general philosophical framework obtained that can embrace both God and man, a chain of being. Is it possible to get a general philosophical concept embracing God and man, the divine and the human, and so that there is, as it were, a sort of a chain of being between God and man, higher and lower in a chain of being? Barth was very much, at least in his claim, he was very much against the analogia entis of Rome, denying that there a general philosophical groundwork could be obtained, embracing both God and man, a chain of being. And furthermore, he maintained that contact with God could be only had in an encounter, not by means of general ideas, not by means of certain rational principles, let us say, that contact with God could be had only in encounter apart from general philosophical considerations. That would be in the once for all revelation in Jesus Christ. This type of thinking has used the Greek expression ephapax. This lays stress on the uniqueness, upon the once-for-all character of the encounter between God and man, that encounter as Kierkegaard understood it, as I say, in his religion B. Let me repeat this because I think it's important, and indeed it will build, we will be building on it later on. Now I said the situation then, that you have this opposition here, you see, between Rome and Karl Barth and so forth. The situation is further complicated by the fact that the dialectical theology, in its opposition to the analogia entis of Rome, claimed to represent the pure motives of the Reformation. In the first place, there was a denial that a general philosophical groundwork can be obtained that embraces both God and man, a chain of being. You cannot get an overall view of being that embraces both God and man. And furthermore, that contact with God is had only in encounter, apart from general philosophical considerations. It is had then in a once-for-all revelation in Jesus Christ, or using this Greek word as they often do, it is ephapax. Now, It has been pointed out, one of the books I shall have you read or read into is a book by William Young, Toward a Reformed Philosophy, which to my mind, I call it a minor classic already, and I'm going to have you at least read into it. Perhaps we can make some copies of pages and so forth that you can use, because it is not that available. But nevertheless, he makes this type of point. The dialectical theology, insofar as it reflects any facet of the spirit of the Reformation, stands more on the side of Martin Luther than of John Calvin. Let us explore a little bit. See? Does it at all reflect any of the motive of the Reformation? If it does at all, he says that it would then reflect Martin Luther rather than John Calvin. Although Martin Luther was the spirit who unleashed the Reformation, now Calvin was, according to my best understanding, quite willing to acknowledge him as the leader of the Reformation. Calvin was a great systematizer of the Reformation. He certainly fought for his own place, but he acknowledged Luther. He was the acknowledged leader of the Reformation. Martin Luther was a spirit who unleashed the Reformation. Although he confessed the central significance of the sovereignty of God, he confessed the sovereignty of God as well as Calvin. Although he confessed the central significance of the sovereignty of God and the claim of the grace of Christ to penetrate all of life, too, along with Calvin, he would admit that God's grace has to penetrate, it has to suffuse into all of life. He never overcame altogether the influence of the nominalistic training he had received at Erfurt, the University of Erfurt. And the training was nominalistic. We'll have to look into that a little bit too. Let's get some of these names down anyway, and we'll try to put some flesh on them as we go along. But he had received training with certain nominalists at Erfurt, and he said rather proudly sometimes, I remember, I am of the school of Occam, who was a leading nominalist thinker. But now the nominalism of the late Middle Ages had replaced the attempt at synthesis that had characterized the High Middle Ages. We already have seen a pattern of this synthesis, you see, that there is reason, there is philosophy, there is a sphere of grace in which there is a help, where there's a completion of this lower area, which is the preamble of grace. If we think of that as a synthetic view of trying to draw these things together, nominalism had replaced such an attempt as synthesis, a synthesis that had characterized the High Middle Ages. If nature had been regarded to be a relatively independent preamble of grace, and if revelation had been regarded as a completion of and not a contradiction of the truths of reason, this area is supposed to complete this, not to contradict. If grace had been regarded then to be a completion of and not a contradiction of the truths of reason, nominalism had replaced its cozy accommodation with a stark antithesis. The tendency then is to set these two over against each other, even as we find in the position of Bart, that philosophy and theology are fairly well set over against, that generality in Kierkegaard and encounter are set over against each other. Now, in this nominalistic influence, grace and revelation now stood starkly over against nature and reason. And a measure of this dualism, as Hermann Dooyeweerd has pointed out, infected, it coursed through Luther's entire thought. Now Luther, according to Dooyeweerd and others, did not admit that there was an organic connection between nature and grace. Failed to see any organic connection He did not admit that there was an organic connection between nature and grace. Instead, he emphasized the freedom of the Christian man, great stress on inwardness, the freedom of the Christian man with respect to the world, with its orders and its laws. Think of the world with its ordinances, with its laws, with its structures that are made by men. We find then that Christian man inwardly is free from the world with its orders and its laws. In the estate of sin, a Christian is bound to the law and to the temporal ordinances. To them, he subjects himself in obedience to the will of God. Indeed, serving God, we subject ourselves to these ordinances, we subject ourselves to these laws in obedience to the will of God. We are bound in the estate of sin to them, and we must seek to inform them with Christian love. We might say, instead of using the word inform, we might say that we ought to infuse them or suffuse them with Christian love. I use a figure sometimes that our Christian love ought to effervesce and spill over, filling up this area of temporal ordinances with Christian love. We must seek to inform them with Christian love. Nevertheless, he is not subject to them in an intimate fashion, in his deepest self. He is free from them. The emphasis is on the inwardness, on the separation from these things which are there because of sin. One is not subject to them internally in his deepest self. Now, Doivert maintains that this dualism appeared also in Luther's view of the church, where you had, again, a division between the inward and the outward. The organization of the visible church was something indifferent. It could be left over to the state authorities to organize that. An antithesis was drawn between the spiritual and the natural, with a depreciation of the latter. And so even though one is involved with these things, with church organization, let us say, it is something that is relatively removed from him. There is an antithesis then between the spiritual and the natural, with a depreciation of the latter. Now, the Christian opposition to nature, then, is not understood exclusively in terms of the corruption of nature because of the fall. Now, that's going to be a position that will be taken by the Calvinistic philosophy, that any tension that I find, any antithesis that I find between myself and the order of law is simply because of sin. There's no inherent dualism. But they say that there is, because of this view, there is such an inherent dualism in Luther. Thus, a basic dualism in line with Luther's Occamistic training comes to the fore in spite of Luther's clear rejection of the ideal of monasticism and so forth.